leaving behind Andrew and IFL, and with them, my dream of producing an exercise video for the elderly and disabled felt strangely liberating. The idea had once sparked something powerful in me, inspired by Michael Watson's grit in using Calinetics to rebuild himself after his near-fatal fight with Eubank, and by the rehabilitation methods pioneered by Valentin Dekel, later embraced by organizations such as Sportability. It gave me purpose at a time when I was searching for meaning. But that chapter had ended. So had my flirtation with lipstick films, the shadowy figures, the wild promises, the teetering edge of legitimacy. That world had begun to blur the lines between reality and risk. Walking away from it wasn't just smart, it was necessary. For the first time in what felt like forever, I exhaled, a long, deliberate breath, and for a brief moment, the crushing weight that had camped on my chest for years seemed to lift. It wasn't quite joy, but it was something close. A flicker of peace in the middle of the storm, a pause, a breath, a whisper of readiness. I was ready to try again. For something real, something honest, something that paid the bills without demanding pieces of my soul in return. But peace, as ever, proved fragile, slipping through my fingers before I could properly grasp it. I found myself drifting again, back into that dense, airless fog that comes with life in limbo, that strange no man's land where the days blur and stretch, and hope feels more like a rumor than a possibility, a faint whisper you can't quite trust. I was broke, flat out. Desperation had rooted itself deep in my bones. I was emotionally wrung out, spiritually empty. My body ached from the effort of simply holding it all together. Financial survival was no longer a struggle. It was a siege. And I was fresh out of reinforcements. So I turned back, to my roots, to the boys I'd grown up with, the ones who knew me before life got sharp, before ambition twisted everything, before grief carved deep lines into the map of who I was. David Tomlinson, my best mate from primary school, a fellow West Ham fanatic. Back then, we were inseparable. Two scrappy lads chasing trouble with the same crooked smile. Who could have imagined that same wild-eyed kid would one day don a collar and become a vicar? But even now, in robes, David still carries that glint in his eye. The one that says we're only ever a joke away from mischief. Then there was Paul Warlock, who arrived in my life at Swanley Comprehensive and never left. We were brothers, though blood had nothing to do with it. We roamed, we danced, we chased youth down every street and every coast, from the Isle of Wight under stars, to Parisian boulevards, to sunburnt days in Florida. Our shared religion? Punk. The Clash. The Members. Susie and the Banshees. The Sex Pistols. The Boomtown Rats. Our hearts thumped to the beat of rebellion, our lives soundtracked by sticky-floored gigs and the electricity of live music. One Night still plays like a scratched record in my head. We were huddled around the telly watching Top of the Pops. Bob Geldof appeared, snarling, unkempt, alive. He tore up a photo of John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John live on air. Rat Trap had knocked grease off the top spot. We leapt to our feet, roaring. That moment wasn't just music, it was a declaration. Punk wasn't a genre, it was the truth, and we felt it in every vein. Then came Squeeze. Not punk, but unmistakably South London. Lyrics like poetry, sharp, clever, real. The soundtrack to our late-night walks and quiet thoughts. Paul, even with his Arsenal loyalties, often joined us at Upton Park when his team played away. Because match days weren't about colors. They were about standing together, chanting till your voice broke, feeling like you belonged. Ray Haynes, unforgettable in every way. He moved with a soft, metallic rhythm, calipers on his legs tapping out their own percussion. But nothing slowed him down. He rose to become Kent's table tennis champion. Tenacious, focused, unbeatable. He was, and still is, a diehard Millwall supporter. On paper, we should have been enemies. West Ham and Millwall, two tribes at war. A rivalry woven into London's DNA, immortalized in films and pub brawls. But with Ray, that didn't matter. The banter flew, sure. The digs came thick and fast. But under it all, respect, shared history, brotherhood. Ray wasn't a rival. He was my mate. David Coleman lived nearby but didn't go to Swanley Comp. Still, he was always one of us, quietly dependable. He was the guy who showed up when others didn't, who remembered birthdays, who never missed a funeral. The steady one, the kind one. And then there was Ron Khalifa. He joined us in the third year, a shy, slight Indian lad in a school of 2,000 white faces. He stuck out, and he paid the price. The bullies circled, but I couldn't watch from the sidelines. I stood up for him. Time and time again. His parents were strict. He rarely came out to play. But we saw him, peering out the window, watching us with longing etched in his face. That image stayed with me. Fast forward 50 years, and Ronnie is Sir Ron Khalifa, former CEO of WorldPay, a non-executive director at the Bank of England, living in Knightsbridge. But none of that changed him. He still smiles the same quiet smile, still calls me mate, and we never lost touch. Ron and I had always stayed close. He lived nearby for years before moving to Knightsbridge, but the friendship never wavered. One evening, we met in Chislehurst, just two old friends nursing pints beneath pub lights that softened life's sharper edges. I opened up, laid it all bare. The fall, the failure, the gnawing question I couldn't escape. What the hell do I do now? Ron just listened. No platitudes, no advice, just that steady, grounding presence I'd always known. Then, quietly, he reached into his jacket and pulled out his checkbook. He wrote me a check, a small, silent gesture that landed like thunder. It wasn't a fortune, but it was everything. A rope tossed to a man drowning. It meant someone still believed in me. I stared at the check, stunned. A lump caught in my throat and refused to move. I thanked him. But later, when I was alone, that familiar whisper returned. What now? Because it wasn't about the money. That check couldn't fix everything. But it reminded me, I wasn't alone. I had friends. Real friends. The kind who don't flinch when the lights go out. Who show up not just for the parties, but for the wreckage. With Ron's encouragement, and others like him, I knew I had to dig deep. Deeper than I'd gone in years. There was no shortcut, no easy way out, just grit, and the quiet strength that came from knowing I still had something left in the tank. Every few months we still gather, usually at the Plow in Bicester. We pass around old stories like battered records, raise pints, laugh until we ache and remember. And then came Fred and Martin, steady as stone. Go back into catering, they said, plain and simple. No ceremony, no fluff. It's what you know, what you're bloody good at. Find a space, we'll back you. And they were right. Catering wasn't just work, it was in my blood. It had connected me to people, sparked ideas, given me purpose. It had launched Pistachios in the Park. It had filled plates, opened doors, and paid the bills. It was home. Going back to it didn't feel like retreat. It felt like a return, like picking up an old instrument and remembering how to play. One plate at a time, one cafe at a time, I'd rebuild. And with their laughter echoing in my mind and the distant thrum of punk still pulsing through my veins, I knew it was time. Time to begin again. Time to rebuild, on my terms. I'd found the perfect location, a corner unit at the Lee Center, tucked behind the bustling traffic of Burnt Ash Road. It was the kind of spot you could easily miss if you weren't looking for it. But for me, it was gold dust. The chance to revive Pistachios, this time as a restaurant and bar. The vision was clear. The only thing missing? Money. With most of my cash tied up in the house and a mortgage hanging over me like a stubborn rain cloud, I had to get creative. That's when I remembered the guy. The Nigerian contact, who was something of a fixer, known to Andrew as the go-to for paperwork that looked very official but had never seen the inside of a filing cabinet. I gave him a call. He was unbothered. No problem, he said, like he was ordering a sandwich. Within days, he'd linked me with Richard, a mortgage broker who clearly didn't believe in asking too many questions. While the loan application was processing, I picked up work as a mini cab driver. Nights were long and the calls from base were relentless, often muffled and crackly over the radio. I solved that problem with a portable cassette recorder. Press, rewind, replay. No need to badger the controller every time they barked out an address that sounded like it had been swallowed by static. Fortunately, I didn't have to wait long. The loan came through, adding £50,000 to my mortgage. I moved my mortgage to the mortgage business, and suddenly the wheels were in motion. Martin and Fred, loyal as ever, rolled up their sleeves and helped me transform the space into Pizza Pistachios, tables, signage, the works. The launch was electric. Even the mayor of Lewisham, Dave Sullivan, popped in to see what the fuss was about. He'd later become an acquaintance, though at the time, he mostly looked bemused that a pizzeria was generating this much local buzz. But glamour fades quickly when you're knee-deep in daily service, chasing suppliers, and counting every penny. The overheads were eye-watering. Everything, labor, equipment, fixtures, drained the pot faster than we could refill it. For a brief window, it looked promising, but our customer base just wasn't big enough. Trade was inconsistent. Bills were not. I was a single dad with three boys, trying to run a restaurant and keep a household afloat. Diane, who I was seeing at the time, helped when she could, mostly during school hours. Her mother, Opal, who I'd trained as a sort of no-nonsense sous chef, stepped in when needed. But when Diane's kids came home from school, she had to go. So the real backbone of my childcare operation became Ben, my eldest. Ben was now at Crown Woods School. Luckily, his day ended before Josh's, so he'd swing by the primary school, pick up his little brother, and bring him to the restaurant. Remy, who was at Thomas Tallis, came on his own. I'd feed them. Then they'd head home, Ben playing the responsible big brother, sorting out the school clothes, bedtime, and even doing the laundry. Then came a scare. One afternoon, Ben walked into the restaurant holding his side and wincing. "Stomach pain," he said. "Probably gas," I figured. "Go buy some Love Hearts," I told him, my version of holistic medicine. But he didn't perk up. I called Diane. She sounded alarmed. "If it's that bad, he should see a doctor," she said. I sent him and Josh off to our GP on Lee Road. About 20 minutes later, the surgery called. Stern voice, urgent tone. Ben had collapsed in the waiting room. They'd called an ambulance. It was a suspected ruptured appendix. I shut the restaurant on the spot and raced to Lewisham Hospital. When I arrived, doctors told me Ben had been in agony but never once cried or panicked. "Brave kid," they said. I was bursting with pride but also racked with guilt. I'd brushed it off. I'd told him to eat sweets. That night, sitting beside his hospital bed, it hit me. Something had to change. I couldn't keep trying to be everything, chef, cabbie, father, manager, debt juggler, while expecting my kids to take care of each other like a makeshift platoon. Diane and I were getting on well. The only logical step was to bring us all under one roof. Before settling on the Leagate site, I'd considered another opportunity. Just down the road, Manor House Gardens had undergone a lottery-funded facelift. What had once been a slightly shabby patch of green, run-down park, near Old Road, now boasted a much-improved clean duck pond with a proper fence, fresh landscaping, and even a shiny new public cafe. Well, almost new. It had been converted from an old brick shelter next to the public loos. The space was modest, but well-positioned, with two large bifolding doors that opened onto the park, perfect for sunny afternoons. I'd inquired early on, thinking it could be a solid spot for something low-key and family-friendly. But Glendale Grounds Management, the company Lewisham Council brought in to oversee the parks, decided to run the cafe themselves. So I moved on, and that's how I ended up launching Pizza Pistachios at Leagate instead. About 6 months into the restaurant grind, I heard whispers that Glendale's cafe wasn't exactly thriving. In fact, they were floundering. It turns out that managing a park cafe was more complicated than just opening the doors and waiting for the lattes to pour themselves. I saw an opening. I approached Craig Davis, the manager at Glendale, and pitched an idea. "Give me a trial run, a 1-year license to trade." I also reached out to Dave Sullivan, now a familiar and supportive presence, thanks to his earlier visit to Pistachios, and he gave his verbal backing. I even got in touch with Daniel Hewitt, the founder's son, based up in Parker, who was now learning the ropes alongside Craig. To my surprise, they agreed. Once again, Martin and Fred came on board, helping fit out the cafe on a tighter budget. Diane put in a small cash injection to get us over the line. We turned the previously empty shell into something warm, clean, and inviting. Pistachios in the Park was born. To run it day to day, I reached out to Matt, a reliable young guy who'd worked with Angie and her sisters. Angie, my first pick, had gone off to train as a nurse. Debbie was busy supporting her partner's hair salon. Matt had the right energy. Capable, punctual, good with people. Within weeks of opening, it became obvious we were onto something. On dry days, Pistachios in the Park was busier than the restaurant, despite operating shorter hours. The cafe shut by dusk in winter and 6 p.m. in summer. Meanwhile, I was still closing the restaurant at 10:30 p.m., mopping the floor after midnight with aching feet and kids waiting at home. Financially, the contrast was even starker. The cafe's costs were a fraction of the restaurant's. I paid £3,500 a year, all utilities included, no business rates, since it was in a public park. The restaurant, on the other hand, was bleeding me dry, £15,000 a year in rent alone, plus bills. It didn't take long to realize the obvious. The restaurant had to go. I listed it on businessesforsale.com, and before long, a Thai chef named Tony reached out. He was keen to take over the lease. Surrendering it wasn't an option yet. I was still within the 3-year term before my break clause kicked in. Subletting was the next best move. Tony paid 3 months up front and continued paying regularly. He put his own spin on the space and quickly built a solid customer base. Just like that, I was free to fully focus on the Park Cafe, a venture that actually worked around my life rather than the other way around. It was a 2-minute walk from home. I could be back with the kids by 6:30 p.m. in summer, 5 p.m. in winter. It wasn't glamorous, but it worked. With the Leagate restaurant now in Tony's capable hands, I finally had breathing room, both financially and mentally. Matt had moved on and joined the police. Pistachios in the Park was proving to be a better fit for our family in every way. The hours were reasonable, the location was close, and the atmosphere was far less stressful than the late-night grind of restaurant service. I could focus on what mattered most, the boys. Ben, in particular, needed more attention. I'd managed to get him a place at Crown Woods School in Eltham, a huge comprehensive with over 2,000 students. It wasn't perfect, but it had the resources, and more importantly, I had secured him a statement of special educational needs, something we'd fought hard for. It meant he now had dedicated one-to-one support in class, finally getting help for what had been wrongly written off as laziness or misbehavior. It turned out Ben had dyslexia. That was the root of so many of his struggles. For years, he'd been trying to keep up in a system that wasn't built for kids like him, and it showed in his frustration, in the way he'd act out or switch off. Now, with the right support, we could finally help him move forward. We also had help from Andy and Cheryl, two local private tutors who generously offered Ben extra lessons. They were kind, patient, and encouraging. During one session, Ben let slip that the only subjects he really enjoyed were drama and dance, the ones that were barely on the school timetable. That stuck with me. I remembered Sally used to take classes at Pineapple Dance Studios in Covent Garden. I got in touch and found out they still ran weekend drama and dance classes for young people. Without hesitation, I signed Ben up. From age 12, every Saturday, Ben would head up to Blackheath Station, jump on a train to Covent Garden, and spend the day training. He absolutely loved it. It gave him confidence, a sense of belonging, and a reason to look forward to weekends. Pineapple's yearly performance was held at the Shaw Theater, and Ben was chosen to take part more than once. One Christmas, he was featured in a televised production on Blue Peter, and another time, he danced on stage with Zoe Burkett, fresh off her run as the highest-placing female finalist from Pop Idol. That particular performance was part of the Queen's Jubilee celebrations, broadcast to millions. Ben didn't have GCSEs, but he had something just as valuable: talent, drive, and a place at the Brit School. He was accepted just as Katie Melua had graduated, and while Adele and Jessie J were still walking the same corridors. It was a proud moment, not just because of where he was going, but because of how far he'd come. Back at the cafe, business was steady and community-focused. I could breathe easier. The working hours meant I could be present as a dad, while still growing something meaningful. I decided we needed to offer something special, something that felt nostalgic but top quality. That's when I thought of Criterion Ices. Once a staple of Sydenham, Criterion had been a beloved family-run ice cream business founded in 1920 by James Alfonso Valenti, the son of Italian immigrants. They sold from hand carts, tricycles, even horse-drawn wagons. James was the kind of man who'd build an ice cream van out of a Model T Ford chassis. The original shop was long gone, but the spirit lived on. The family had relocated to a farm in Suffolk, still producing ice cream using traditional methods. Fresh milk, real cream, no corners cut. I contacted Jim Valenti, James' grandson, who was now in charge of sales. He was delighted by the idea of reintroducing Criterion to Lewisham. Not long after, we had a branded freezer in the cafe, fully stocked with their award-winning ice cream. The reaction was immediate. Customers would light up when they recognized the name. Some hadn't tasted it since childhood. It became an instant hit. With the ice cream drawing people in, I decided to revive some of our classic pistachio sandwiches from our Greenwich and Blackheath days. The hot brie and cranberry baguette, the pistachios club, and the infamous tuna priest. That last one always got questions. It sounded like something out of a religious cookbook, but the name was an inside joke. It referred to the little club anglers used to give fish their last rites. People loved the quirk, and it got them talking. I made a point to be out front as much as I could, chatting to customers, remembering orders, hearing stories. My boys all chipped in over time, cooking, clearing tables, washing up. Even Caitlin joined in. Diane helped in the early days, then stepped back so her mum Opal could take on a proper paid role. Opal was reliable, hardworking, and great with customers. Theo, however, didn't work at the cafe. His father, Philip, would collect him most weekends or during school holidays, taking him to Eastbourne before returning him just in time for school. During the week, Diane was all about structure, homework, baths, bedtime routines. She could be funny with her parenting tricks, too. Theo had an eating disorder as a child and had been in and out of Great Ormond Street Hospital before being diagnosed as lactose intolerant and allergic to nuts. He couldn't eat ice cream from the street vans that roamed the neighborhood in summer, ringing their bells like sirens of forbidden joy. To spare him disappointment, Diane came up with a genius lie. "That's not an ice cream van, it's the bath man. He rings his bell to let kids know it's bath time, then bed." For years, Theo and Caitlin would freeze mid-play and march inside when they heard the familiar jingle. It worked a treat. During the week, I managed the cafe with the help of part-time staff. One of them, Lana, she was a Ukrainian cleaner from a private school in Blackheath. She worked her early morning shift, came straight to the cafe by 10 a.m., did her hours till 3 p.m., and then returned for her evening cleaning round. Weekends were covered by local sixth formers. The boys were still too young to work, though Ben was a huge help. Remy and Josh spent most of their time playing in the park. They had their freedom and a familiar place to run wild safely. While Sally was ill, her mum, Barbara, had two Bichon Frise. When one of them had a litter, they gave us a puppy, a gift to our family. We named him Grubby. He quickly became part of the pack, bonding closely with our older Old English sheepdog, Bramble. They were an odd pair, but inseparable. Bramble was the first to go. He developed leukemia and had to be put down. That loss came before Sally passed, and it hit us hard. But Grubby carried on, a little scruff ball of loyalty and spirit, who stayed by our sides as we tried to move forward. He was with us through all the change, through the move, the cafe, and eventually, Diane and her children. He grew older with us, and though his eyes faded and his pace slowed, he remained a faithful companion. When his health finally began to fail, it was Diane who gently took him to the vet for the last time. She did it quietly, kindly. Josh, still young at the time, struggled with the loss. Diane's had a dog living with her at her house in Manor Lane, Ellie, a red and white King Charles Cavalier, which would come to us when Diane did. Josh missed having a dog of his own. Then one day, a customer at the cafe mentioned a litter of Bichon puppies for sale in Ashford. Josh and I went to have a look. He instantly connected with one of them, a soft, spirited pup with the same cheeky spark that Grubby had once had. We brought him home and named him Ash after the town. From that moment, Josh and Ash were a duo. Ash rode in the back of Josh's Ninja Turtle backpack as he zipped around on his BMX, his little white ears flapping in the wind. Josh taught him tricks, spin, jump, even walk on his hind legs. Ash never needed a lead. He never strayed. Except, of course, when he sniffed out chocolate. Then he turned into a wild-eyed blur of chaos. But we loved him for it.